Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'd like to extend a warm welcome to our new listeners on KVRF Radio Free Palmer. That's a community radio station in Palmer, Alaska. Every Friday, we speak with a panel of journalists about coverage of the week's news, and we go beyond the headlines to talk about the role the media play in shaping our understanding of some of the most pressing issues of our time. On today's show, we are discussing coverage of the student-led March for Our Lives rallies around the globe and how this movement is changing media coverage of gun control, the NRA, and the need for resources in communities of color. Later in the show, we'll discuss the Trump administration's plan to add a citizenship question to the upcoming census, and then we will hear about a year-long investigation examining lead poisoning in the San Francisco Bay Area from KALW News. Kicking off today's show is Alex Yablon, a reporter at The Trace, an independent nonprofit news outlet dedicated to shining a light on gun violence in the United States. Hi, Alex. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you. As we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we like to highlight journalism that stood out this week. So what caught your attention this week, Alex?
I was very impressed by a piece by Melissa Jeltsin of the Huffington Post about the trial of Noor Salman, who was just this morning it was announced. This is the widow of the Pulse nightclub shooter. Just this morning, she was acquitted of providing support, material support to terrorism and obstruction of justice. And I just felt like Melissa Jeltsin's piece in the Huffington Post about the trial really, you know, was very evocative of this woman, you know, who's at the center of, you know, one of the worst crimes in, you know, recent American history, but is sort of the only person left to hold accountable for a crime she didn't commit. And you know, obviously today we now know that, you know, she was acquitted. But I thought it was a really stellar piece of court reporting.
And just quickly, because this is getting national headlines, was it about this piece that grabbed your attention?
I just thought it really, you know, it really dissected the case and the what evidence they were underlay the charges, which, you know, as was clear from the piece and the verdict, was not very much, and was clear how, you know, the charges were really contradicted by texts that she made, suggesting she really had no idea what was going on the night of the shooting. Mm-hmm. You know, they pointed to a portrait also, I think, of the role that the domestic violence and an abusive relationship can play in gun violence. What a clear sign of future, you know, violence it can be, and how monstrous Omar Mateen the killer was in his personal life.
So kudos to Melissa Jeltsin of the Huffington Post. This piece is called How Noor Salman Became the Scapegoat of the Pulse Massacre. Prosecutors say she helped her husband's terror attack. Her supporters say she's innocent and the case is rooted in gendered Islamophobia. And we'll put a link to that piece at yourcallradio.org. And I wanted to give kudos to a couple of news outlets that are covering the suicides that we're seeing by New York City taxi drivers. One in particular from Wired's Miranda Katz starts off by saying it was a somber scene outside of New York City Hall on Wednesday afternoon. Four coffins sat at the foot of the steps, one by one. Taxi drivers covered them with white flowers before assembling on the steps and shouting for the city to stop Uber's greed and stop making us slaves. The latest person to commit suicide was Nicanor Ochisor on March 16th, a 65-year-old yellow cab driver who took his own life in his Queens home. Wired covered this, Newsweek covered this, and New York City Patch covered this. The New York Daily News also did. It did not get coverage on NPR, The New York Times, or The Washington Post. And so I just wanted to point that out. It's kind of shocking that these suicides are not getting more attention, and we will definitely do shows about this in the coming weeks. Alex, we wanted to bring you on because you work for an incredible organization called The Trace. You specifically focus on gun violence in the United States. And according to the research you've all done, every year in the United States, a firearm is used in nearly 500,000 crimes, resulting in the deaths and injuries of more than 110,000 people. And in your stories, you report that these shootings devastate families. They drain billions of dollars from local, state, and federal governments. This is your beat. You specifically focus on gun violence. How do you think this youth-led movement has changed the conversation around gun violence and also NRA political contributions?
I think it's changed it pretty massively. You know, we're pretty used to the reaction to these kinds of mass shootings fading very quickly, and that's not happening. You know, we're almost a month and a half out from this last shooting, you know, which was not as deadly as the Las Vegas shooting, which was not as deadly as the Sutherland Springs shooting, and yet has really, you know, been at the top of the national agenda for, you know, what feels like in 2018 an eternity. And I think that's really down to these kids and the really unified and, frankly, aggressive stance that they've taken. You know, I think in the past we're used to seeing a lot of sadness from, you know, survivors and relatives. And this time we see a lot of anger and energy. And, you know, I think it's put a lot of folks like Marco Rubio kind of on the back foot. I don't think they're used to people making clear in such direct terms with such a personal connection that the kind of standard post-shooting response just doesn't cut it anymore. You know, I think they're very clear that, you know, that there's sort of canned lines, I think, that a lot of Republicans and the NRA will come out with after mass shootings. And, you know, for the first time, I think you're really seeing people directly connected to one of these tragedies say, sorry, we don't buy it.
Mm. And what was incredible about the first forum is seeing these students pointedly ask politicians like Marco Rubio, will you stop taking money from the NRA? I mean, you don't really hear many reporters ask such pointed questions.
No, I mean, I think it's the sort of thing that, you know, certainly I would, you know, you would never, it's so outside the realm of normal political discourse, you know, and yet it's, you know, it's the elephant in the room. These folks take, you know, these politicians take very pro-gun positions because there's a really powerful political organization pushing them to. And, you know, though we all kind of know about that, you know, we understand that connection between the NRA and gun policy. I don't think we, you know, we kind of treat it as just the way things are. And I think these kids, you know, didn't, you know, they refused to see it as, you know, inevitably just the way things are.
The Parkland students also have created a space for people from poor communities and communities of color. At the rally last weekend, we saw people from South Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., Chicago, talking about gun violence on their streets and connecting it directly to the lack of resources, mostly in communities of color. And these kids, these youth, really forced everyone to hear their stories based on their terms. How do you think that has changed the coverage?
Yeah, I think that, the attempt to unify these phenomenon of mass shootings and then, you know, quote unquote everyday gun violence is also something different. I think it has happened kind of in passing after past mass shootings. You know, I there was a famous speech that I don't remember the particular shooting President Obama was referring to, but after one, you know, shooting in 2015 or 2016, you know, Obama was giving very emotional remarks and said in passing, you know, and this happens every day on the streets of Chicago, but then he moved on. But I think that, you know, because the response to this is being led not so much by elected officials who are giving one speech or, you know, or two and then moving on, but rather by a movement that is seeking to, you know, build as broad a coalition as possible, you're seeing more of these connections being drawn so that, you know, different progressive activists and you know, marginalized communities kind of feel, you know, like that this is their fight too. And you know, something that I've heard a lot about is that a lot of gun violence prevention groups don't do a great job. You know, I'm thinking here of like the Brady Campaign and Everytown, don't necessarily connect very well with the communities, you know, poor Black and Latino communities that are most affected by everyday shootings. And these kids have made a very clear point of making sure that they do connect. You know, I saw David Hogg speaking about the effects that police violence, you know, has on communities of color, and also of, you know, racial gerrymandering, and how that can, you know, disenfranchise communities that maybe have ways they would like to respond to gun violence but are unable to because they lack the political power.
And David Hogg is a Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School student. In a recent interview with Axios, he was asked, what do you think about media coverage? And he said, media are not giving Black students a voice. Yesterday, the Miami Herald had a piece about Black Marjorie Stoneman Douglas students saying that they want their voices heard too. 11% of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High's 3,000 students are Black, according to this piece by Alex Harris, but you wouldn't know it from the media coverage of the school's mass shootings. And Black students gathered in Parkland on Wednesday and said they felt overlooked and underrepresented by the media and their peers leading the charge for more gun control. One student, Kai Korber, a 17-year-old, said that he's concerned that the campus is going to be swarmed with police officers. And to him, extra police do not mean more protection. It means more chances of becoming a victim of police brutality.
Yeah, no, I saw that as well. And it's really striking, you know, how that was not really something that figured into discussions of, you know, school safety in the immediate aftermath. It's taken a few weeks for this to bubble up into mainstream consciousness, but it is a really serious issue, mm-hmm. you know, because, you know, school shootings are rare occurrences, but, you know, these teachers would be there, you know, every day that school's open, and that would become a part of, you know, disciplinary practice, which we know, you know, Black students are subjected to disproportionate discipline in schools compared to white students. And when you have armed guards, there's a big worry about what that could, you know, if that could escalate.
I also wanted to ask you, Alex, about funding to study public health. The federal funding bill signed last week included a line that says the CDC has the authority to conduct research on the causes of gun violence. And you asked some of the country's leading gun violence researchers for their thoughts, and they said that it really amounts to nothing because there's no funding.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's clear also that it doesn't really, you know, not only does it not amount to any, you know, there's no funding included in this budget. So, you know, even if the infamous Dickey Amendment, which is the rider attached to the CDC's budget every year, which prohibits, you know, research that could condone or encourage gun control, even if, you know, there's this clarification, there's no extra money to actually fund the research. And some added that, well, the clarification doesn't really change anything. It's obvious from a reading of the law that, you know, research into causes was never prohibited by the Dickey Amendment. But the thing is that what a lot of researchers are interested in is not the causes, but how to remedy gun violence. Mm. And that still, you know, could potentially run afoul of this budget, this restriction in the budget, and the clarification doesn't really address it. Again, it only specifies that research into causes is okay.
Alex, just briefly, what are you working on right now?
Right now, I'm looking into the fate of a lot of these red flag laws around the country. These are known, you know, in California as gun violence restraining orders. We just published a piece late yesterday that just rounded up all of the proposals in the rest of the states. I believe there are 21 states now that are considering them. And we're trying to see if, you know, the NRA released a statement that seemed to endorse them, these emergency gun seizure laws about 2 weeks ago, but we're seeing what they're actually doing when states try to pass them. And generally, they still seem to oppose it. And I'm also looking into an effort by some Florida politicians and, you know, political operatives to get a constitutional amendment on the ballot in that state banning assault weapons.
Well, Alex, thank you for your reporting and thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Alex Yablon is a reporter at The Trace, an independent nonprofit news outlet dedicated to shining a light on gun violence in the United States. You can find his reporting and more from The Trace at yourcallradio.org. And now I would like to welcome Ari Berman to the show. Ari is a senior writer with Mother Jones and author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. One of Ari's recent pieces is Hidden Figures, How Donald Trump is Rigging the Census, Efforts to Sideline Minority Populations in 2020 will undermine democracy for decades to come. Hi, Ari. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rose. Thanks for having me back.
It's great to have you. So this is starting to get a lot of media attention. The Trump administration plans to add a question to the upcoming census. Are you a citizen? At least 12 states have said that they will sue the administration over plans to ask this question. Ari, where did this question come from in the administration?
Well, it originally came from the Justice Department, and that's what's so interesting about this question, which is that there have been problems with the 2020 census for quite some time. I've been following this for months. But in December, things really sharpened when the Justice Department said they wanted this question on citizenship added to the census by March of 2018, which in census terms is an incredibly short timeline, because every single new question on the census is rigorously tested through focus groups, by the Census Bureau in the field, and there was no time to test it. And then secondarily, the Justice Department's rationale for this, that they needed it to enforce the Voting Rights Act, which is completely laughable, given that it was coming from the Trump administration, which hasn't taken a single effort, a single lawsuit, any sort of initiative to enforce the Voting Rights Act, and actually has turned its back on enforcing the Voting Rights Act and other civil rights laws. And so when the Justice Department made this request, it was obviously very serious because it was coming from some very powerful people in the administration. And then this Monday, Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross decided that he was going to add this question to the census. And it's such a big deal because it's only one question, but it really gets to the heart of the census, which is the census is supposed to count everyone, citizen and non-citizen, documented and undocumented. The mission of the census is to accurately count every person in America. And if millions of immigrants don't respond to the census because they're afraid of what the Trump administration will do with that information, the census will be unfair, it'll be inaccurate, and it will hurt certain communities, particularly communities with lots of immigrants, lots of people of color, places like California more than some other places that are whiter, more conservative, and more Republican. So it's a really, really huge deal.
It is a huge deal. And as you report, the 2010 census, the most accurate to date, overcounted white residents by about 1%, failing to count 1.5 million people of color, including 1.5% of Hispanics, 2.1% of blacks, 4.9% of Native Americans on reservations. That is a very high percentage. How did that 2010 census affect these communities?
What happened is the census determines how $675 billion in federal funding is allocated to states and localities, and it also determines how voting districts are drawn and how many electoral votes and congressional seats each state receives. So if there's an undercount, that's what it's called when someone is not counted by the census. If there's an undercount, that means that those communities that are undercounted are going to get less resources. They're going to get less economic resources. They're going to have less political power as a result. So California has already lost out on billions of dollars in federal funding as a result of the undercount. California, for example, has the highest number of immigrants in the country, the highest number of foreign-born people in the country, the highest number of undocumented immigrants in the country. And so the stakes for a place like California are extremely high here. California has done its own estimate, and they found that a significant undercount in 2020 could cost, say, $20 billion in federal funding for things like health care and food stamps and education. And they found that it could cost the state up to 2 congressional seats, which is really, really serious in terms of the representation in the Electoral College and the representation in the U.S. House. And so really the census, as I say in my article, it forms the basis for our democracy. It forms the basis for how we do so many things in our democracy, from allocating resources to allocating political power. And if the census is unfair and if the census is inaccurate, that's going to affect everything else in our democracy too. So it's kind of like the DNA of our democracy. If you pollute the DNA, you're going to pollute everything else.
And there's so much money at stake. As you report, the census determines how $675 billion in federal funding is allocated to states and localities. We're talking about public housing, roads, healthcare, schools, at a time when, because we're seeing massive tax cuts, we're seeing massive budget cuts. I mean, teachers in Oklahoma are planning to walk out on Monday. We're talking with teachers in West Virginia, Oklahoma, Arizona, here in the Bay Area, because they are strapped due to budget cuts. So this will just make that worse?
Yeah, that will make it worse. And the situation with regards to immigration is particularly precarious, Rose, because my piece was set in Fresno in the Central Valley in California, mm-hmm. and I did this reporting before the citizenship question was added. But I asked immigrants there, both documented and undocumented, would you respond to the census if it included a question about citizenship, because we knew this was possible. They all told me no. They said, we don't trust the Trump administration with our information. And they're incredibly afraid. There is ICE raids all over the place. You have the head of ICE telling California they better hold on tight. You have Donald Trump demonizing immigrants on a seemingly daily basis. So all of that was happening before they added this question about citizenship. And now we have a situation where the census, which is a constitutionally mandated activity for every decade since 1790 to count every person in America, the census is now being turned into a weapon for the Trump administration. They're taking what should be a constitutional responsibility, and they're trying to make it a tool for deporting immigrants, for denying communities representation and resources. And so to me, this is so serious because of all the voter suppression things that I'm covering, and I cover voting rights as a beat, to me, this is the most serious because the census affects so many things in our society.
California and 11 other states are suing. As you report, California has the country's largest immigration population. What do you expect will come from these lawsuits?
I think these lawsuits are going to be really serious. I think they're going to be really serious for two reasons. Number one, the census very clearly states that it counts and the actual population. I know there's a lot of people that don't want citizens to be counted, non-citizens to be counted, but that's not how the census works. The census is supposed to accurately count everyone in this country. It's not supposed to discriminate against people based on how they came here. As long as they're here, they're supposed to be counted. So, number one, the citizenship question gets to the core purpose of the census itself.
And
number
Ari, can you hold that thought on number two? We just have to take a quick break. Today
Absolutely. On
Your Calls Media Roundtable, we're speaking with Ari Berman, senior writer for Mother Jones and author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. And you can find Ari's latest piece for Mother Jones, Hidden Figures, How Donald Trump is Rigging the Census. Efforts to sideline minority populations in 2020 will undermine democracy for decades to come. You can find his piece at yourcallradio.org. As Ari reports, there's a lot of money on the line. The census determines how $675 billion in federal funding is allocated to states and localities every year. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW, local public radio. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. And let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. If you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can email yourcall@kalw.org or leave a comment on the website at yourcallradio.org. Or tweet us at Your Call Radio.
This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Joining us today is Ari Berman, senior writer with Mother Jones and author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. We're speaking with Ari Berman about the Trump administration's plan to add a citizenship question to the upcoming census. And this is starting to get media attention. What are your thoughts on the attention it's getting? What questions do you have about this? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also drop us an email, yourcall@kalw.org. And in about 10 minutes, we will hear about a year-long investigation examining lead poisoning in the San Francisco Bay Area from KALW News. All right, Ari, you were talking about the two things that really concern you about this. What's the second one?
Well, I was talking about how the law will be challenged in court, how the proposed citizenship question will be challenged in court. And one way it'll be challenged is that they'll say it violates the core constitutional responsibility of the census, which is to accurately count everyone who's here, including non-citizens. The second way I think it will be challenged is that this question didn't go through any of the proper testing or vetting. That one of the things Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross said when he approved this question was that we wouldn't know what the impact will be. Well, we don't know the impact precisely because the Trump administration added it so late that there couldn't be any testing on it, that all of the questions on the census form, there's only about 10 questions on the entire census form, they go through rigorous testing. But this question was added so late that it didn't go through any of the normal testing. And in fact, this month, the census is having its only test to prepare for 2020 in Providence, Rhode Island. They canceled all the other tests because of budget cuts. And this citizenship question won't even be on the census. So I know anecdotally that this is going to have a suppressive effect because I've talked to lots of immigrants who say they won't respond to the form. Census Bureau surveys have seen similar fears. But in terms of the science, if this question was added in the field and tested, we would have had definitive evidence that it did have a suppressive effect, but the Trump administration specifically designed it so that there wouldn't be any time to test it so they could say, oh, we don't know what the impact will be. So the whole thing was very, very deceptive in terms of how they did this.
When people get this census, what if they just don't answer the question?
They could do that. I think a lot of people will do that. You're required by law to respond to the census itself, but as long as you respond to the rest of it and you have an address, your form will be counted. However, one of the things that I'm concerned about is I think the long-term goal of the Republican Party is to add this question so they can only count citizens for purposes of redistricting and drawing districts. Right now, districts are based on total population. And indeed, 2 years ago, the Supreme Court ruled that districts should be based on everyone who lives there because non-citizens are entitled to representation too. But I think what Republicans want to do is change that, which would mean that areas with lots of immigrants receive less representation as a result. So if people who are citizens decide to not fill out that form, they could then not be counted for purposes of redistricting, which is one thing that I'm concerned about. So I think there's a lot of potential side effects here. I think it's more likely that people just decide not to respond to the census at all. And I think that in some ways would be playing right into the Trump administration's hands because I don't think they want you to respond to the census. But at the same time, it's hard to tell someone, particularly someone who's undocumented at this day and age, yeah, you should trust the Census Bureau and the Trump administration with your information.
This administration is very good at distracting people, and the media tend to take the bait. The census issue is getting a lot of attention from the Miami Herald, the New York Times, the New Yorker is going in depth about the motives behind this question on citizenship. Ari, what role do you think the media can play here to really inform people about the census? This is not something that a lot of people pay much attention to.
I think the media could be tremendously helpful with this because most people don't think about the census until they get it once every 10 years in April of the off decades, or April of 2020 or April of 2030. That's the only time you really think about the census. And people fill it out. They don't really think much of it. But so I think the Trump administration was betting that this was all going to operate in darkness, in secrecy. And the census has been facing a tremendous amount of problems before this, from cuts to their budget it to a lack of leadership. The head of the Census Bureau resigned in June of last year, and there's no full-time head, to new technology. They're using the internet for the first time to conduct much of the census, which raises really intense cybersecurity fears given Russian hacking and everything that went on the last election. And so the census was already facing a lot of problems before this question was proposed and added. And so I think, you know, by really, really pushing the media, they can not only put pressure on the administration, but they can also put pressure on the Congress to do its job with oversight, because Congress oversees the Census Bureau, and they can change this question if they don't like it. And one of the things that I'm concerned about is that there seemingly are no Republicans who are speaking out about this. And I think that's really detrimental, because yes, this is going to affect states like California. It's also going to really affect places like Texas and Florida and Nevada and Arizona, where there are a lot of Republicans. They're going to also lose billions of dollars in funding and political representation as well, because their states have a lot of immigrants too.
We have a great question from Helen, who says, "We are all illegal. What would happen if we all claim to be non-citizens?" Well, half of my family are native, so I guess half of me is illegal. But not all of us are illegal. But this is an interesting question, Ari. What if people said, "I'm a non-citizen"?
Well, then the problem would be that we would have very inaccurate data on who our citizenship population is. And one of the things, one of the real importances of the census is it's the most comprehensive and important survey on the country. So, I mean, back in 1790, our founding fathers requested a census because they needed to know who lived here for all sorts of reasons. And during the Civil War, that information was critical to generals as they were trying to plot, Union generals were trying to plot supply lines through the South. And now the census is used by practically every institution, from the military to nonprofits to universities to the government, to try to understand their populations. And if suddenly the entire population is skewed, then we're not going to be able to make very basic fundamental decisions about our populations because we don't have the data on them.
Mm-hmm. Ari, I have one last question for you. When you wrote an explosive piece in December about how voter suppression threw Wisconsin to Trump, I was hoping that this would get a lot more attention. We want to have you on again in the future to talk more about this, but have you found anything else about voter suppression in 2016?
Well, I mean, I've just been continuing to dig on the impact of it, and I think the impact was more substantial than a lot of people realize, and I think, you know, that piece luckily did get a fair amount of attention. But there's so many other things going on right now that it's tough to look backwards at this point when so many things are unfolding in front of us that could be a huge disaster in 2018 and 2020. So I'm continuing to write on voter suppression, but there's also all the gerrymandering that's going on. There's the census now. There's the upcoming midterm. And there's the presidential election. So unfortunately, I have my hands full at the moment.
Well, we are grateful for your reporting. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Rose. Always great to talk to you.
You too. Ari Berman is a senior writer with Mother Jones, author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. And you can find Ari's reporting at yourcallradio.org. And now we are going to talk about an incredible investigation from KALW News environment and health reporters Angela Johnston and Marissa Ortega Welch. 40 years after lead paint was banned in California, there are neighborhoods in the San Francisco Bay Area with higher rates of childhood lead poisoning than Flint, Michigan. Angela Johnston and Marissa Ortega Welch spent more than a year sifting through data, conducting interviews, chasing down public records, and going into the field. And Angela and Marissa join me in studio. Hi, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Rose.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Well, I finally had time to listen to all of your pieces, and they are incredible. You spent a year on this investigation, which is what it really takes these days to really dig into this information. What really sparked this, Angela?
What sparked it was this Reuters report, actually, that came out over a year ago, and it said that there are places all over the country that have childhood lead levels higher than Flint, Michigan. And one of those places that they highlighted briefly was Fruitvale. And Marissa lives on the border of Fruitvale, and we know Fruitvale well in the Bay Area. And so that really shocked us. And we said, we want to go into this community. We want to go into the East Bay in general, because there were a lot of little neighborhoods all over Alameda County that had higher lead levels than Flint. And so we wanted to meet the people that were really living this reality, that statistic.
And just to let our listeners outside of the area know, Fruitvale is in Oakland in the East Bay.
Right. And what the Reuters report showed is that while overall the Bay Area has childhood lead poisoning rates that are similar to the national average, if you zoom in, there are these hot spots like Fruitvale, other parts of East Oakland, West Oakland, Emeryville, also the Mission District here in San Francisco.
Fremont, which is in the South Bay.
That have extremely high lead levels, three times the national average.
You report that this lead is not caused by running water through old pipes, which is what we saw in Flint, but this is mostly coming from lead-based paint in old homes, and kids living in these old homes can ingest the lead paint. And as you report, and you've asked many people that you interviewed, we have known about this since the 1970s. Why is this still a problem? What struck you the most based on your interviews?
So Oakland, for example, 80% of the homes in Oakland are old housing stock. San Francisco, it's almost 90%. And you can paint over that lead paint, right? We can live with lead paint. You can contain it. But what's happening is in a lot of older homes, some landlords aren't maintaining the property as well, either because they don't know or they're just not wanting to invest the time and money. And so that's what's putting little kids at risk, right? They're actually just peeling off the paint and eating it. Lead actually tastes sweet. That's another thing we've known for a long time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, kids are also just, little kids are prone to putting things in their mouth. But even the dust itself is enough to poison a kid. Actually, one of the people that we interviewed told us, if you imagine a sugar packet that you put into a cup of coffee, if you sprinkled that around a room and then a baby crawled through that room, just that amount of lead getting on their hands and then eventually going into their mouths is enough to make a kid sick.
And also, you know, it's these old homes with old paint, but when renovations happen and there's a lot of homes that are being, you know, rebuilt and knocked down, or there are parents who are working on those repairs, they may get dust all over their clothes and then bring it into their house, and a child, like that sugar packet analogy, may just touch, you know, their dad's shirt or their mom's shirt and put that their hands in their mouth. Or, you know, you're walking down the street and you go by a construction site. So there, you know, there are many different ways that the lead paint from old homes can get into a child's system.
And as you report, lead is a toxin. It gets in blood, it gets in the brain, it interferes with neurons. It's especially bad for kids with a developing brain. So we're talking about young children. And then long term, it can cause permanent learning disabilities. What else did you learn about how lead actually affects our bodies, especially young children?
Yeah, this is another thing that we've known for a very long time. Lead is linked to learning disabilities, behavioral disorders. It actually causes kids to act out and be violent. And so there has been reporting done for years. And actually, Kevin Drum from Mother Jones has been reporting for years about the link between crime rates in certain cities and our use of lead.
It's really fascinating reporting and really interesting studies, you know. When they banned lead in gasoline, we get unleaded fuel at the pump now. But when it was leaded, that correlation between crime rates and the amount of lead in gasoline is really connected, which is really interesting. And, you know, it's tough because there are, you know, there are people that may go through their lives not knowing that maybe their attention deficit disorder or their IQ or their learning disability may actually be caused by something environmental. And it's really hard to tell because the symptoms can present themselves in so many different ways.
It was heartbreaking to hear you speak with families who had their children tested and learned that their children do have lead in their blood. You spoke with a number of families. What really struck you the most about that?
Like Angela was just saying, some of these symptoms are sort of vague. Like lead causes a loss of appetite. It causes, you know, sort of erratic, violent behavior or hyperactivity. And, you know, you could think, well, maybe that's just my kid, mm-hmm. right? But then more and more the symptoms become severe. I mean, we talk to families who their young child, you know, age 2, was only drinking their mother's milk. Another family would just eat like one tortilla a day, and the mom would have to fight with her son to even eat that. So it almost takes all the hard parts about being a kid and being a parent and amplifies it. And then there's this fear that your kid's going to end up with permanent damage. And a lot of parents feel like it was their fault,
Right, a lot of shame.
Right, yeah, shame and guilt that, you know, they put their kid in this unsafe house and exposed their kid to the lead paint, even though, you know, clearly that's not their fault. They were just, living where they needed to live and you know, not even knowing what their kid was being exposed to.
Today we're joined by Marissa Ortega-Welch and Angela Johnston. They are reporters with Cross Currents, KALW Public Radio's award-winning news magazine. And we're speaking with them about a year-long investigation examining lead poisoning in the San Francisco Bay Area. I mean, this is a nationwide problem. And Angela and Marissa looked specifically here in the San Francisco Bay Area. And if you have any questions or comments about their findings, we'd love to hear from you. A lot of people are probably shocked to learn that this is still a problem because we've known about this since the 70s in this state of California. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you'd like to know about whether or not you can get your paint tested, and then you talked, Marissa, earlier about painting over the lead paint. I'll ask you about that in a minute. But if you have any questions or concerns about this, we'd love to hear from you. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. So many of us live in old homes. How can we determine whether the paint that we currently have has lead in it? And then do you have to buy a special paint to paint over the lead paint?
Most paint, all paint now shouldn't have lead in it. So you can paint over your old paint, and that will contain it. But you have to keep that up because eventually it will wear down, especially on windowsills and door frames where there's a lot of friction all the time. But, you know, if you are concerned, we actually have on the KLW website, there is a list of resources. It differs by county and by city. But right now, I think we have San Francisco and Alameda County resources up. And if you're in the East Bay, you can actually get a voucher.
You can get a voucher to test your water. Because we're the Bay Area, there's so many different resources depending on where you live. But the Alameda County Healthy Homes Department, for lower-income families or for landlords that rent to low-income tenants that have kids, you can apply for some funding. It's actually from HUD, Housing and Urban Development. And you can have the county come out and test your house for lead and then help you with some of the repairs. But a lot of it is pretty basic. It's just paint, painting over, peeling paint, maintaining it over years.
You report that 1.2 million children in the United States have lead poisoning, but half of these cases are going undetected. So what can parents do to test their kids?
So the best time to get your kid tested is at age one and age two. You can just ask your family doctor to have your kid tested. I mean, talk with them first, right? We don't want to scare everybody into getting their kids tested. I think the first thing to do is just talk with your doctor and consider what the risks are. Are you living in an old home? Is there peeling paint? And then go ahead and get your kid tested.
And some doctors will automatically do that, but there are a set of risk factors determined by the California Department of Public Health. And it really does differ clinic by clinic. Certain clinics will test everybody, and then we're finding that there are some doctors who aren't testing kids. And so when we started looking at the numbers, we realized there were a lot of holes. And we did find another study that showed that not every kid who should be getting tested is getting tested. So there may be more children out there with lead poisoning than the numbers show.
Once parents learn that their kids have lead in their bodies, what's the treatment plan?
It depends on how high the lead levels are, but the first thing to do is remove or contain the source of lead, right? You got to get the kid away from the lead. So painting over that peeling paint. I mean, if you've been doing construction or remodeling, you need to go in and clean. And that's something people need to know, is that there's lead-safe practices for if you're doing home renovation yourself, you need to be looking into what lead-safe practices are. So getting the kid away from the lead. Nutrition is actually really helpful. The tricky thing about lead is that it mimics calcium in our body. And so the more you can give kids things that have calcium, also things that are high in iron and vitamin C, will help a child's body prevent them from absorbing the lead further into their body. But you, of course, also want to talk with your doctor. The most aggressive treatment for lead is something called chelation, where they use a chemical to draw heavy metals like lead out of the body.
And this is also a class and race issue, because right now, it's so expensive. Most people, there's no way they can move right now. Some people are not even asking their landlord to do upgrades or to paint a wall to get rid of the lead because they're afraid they're going to get evicted. And you found that in your reporting.
Yeah. We met one family who they found a bunch of mold in their apartment. And through that, they took their daughter to the hospital to get her tested for mold and the effects of mold. And then they found she had a very high lead level. And they worked up the courage to complain to their landlord. And after a bunch of, they said they complained too much and he evicted them. They say he evicted them and they're in a lawsuit right now. But, you know, they eventually ended up moving. They lived in San Leandro. They had to move to Milpitas. They moved in with another family. We met a bunch of families who were kind of all in this situation. Another family, speaking of chelation, the treatment, their son had to go to the hospital for 3 weeks to have this. He had one of the highest lead levels the county had ever seen. Mm-hmm. The unsafe level, they say, is no level is safe, but the level for intervention is 5. He had 72. So he's in the hospital for 3 weeks. They eventually moved to Antioch for a bit, but then their public health nurse, the nurse we followed, found them affordable housing. And now, you know, he's doing a lot better. But that was really lucky. You know, there was, I think, how many thousands of people were on the wait list and they managed to get it.
Right. And this public health nurse that we followed in her job told us that families often have to move, and she sees a lot of them leave the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. So there's this weird way that lead poisoning is playing into the displacement of lower income families. And then she also sometimes has to recommend that they voluntarily go into a homeless shelter so that they can, you know, that bumps up their chances of getting on an affordable housing wait list.
Yeah, that really surprised us when she said that.
Are you talking about Diep Tran?
Diep.
Diep Tran?
Yeah.
This was such an amazing woman. Alameda County public health nurse Diep Tran told you that she thought she'd be out of a job by now. She said, our plan was for lead poisoning to be gone, eradicated by 2010, and yet we are still getting too many cases. She says she has 150 cases. She works with little kids who have eaten lead paint or have inhaled lead dust. An amazing woman.
Yes.
Really,
yes. And Diep was so many things. She's not just a nurse. She's a connector. You know, she'll introduce families that have lead poisoning to each other so that they have a network, a community. She's helping them find affordable housing. She's teaching them about nutrition. She's teaching them about lead safe practices. I mean, she's really doing a lot to help these families deal with this problem because lead affects so many different parts of the lives. It's not just your physical health.
What response have you received from state officials to this report?
No word yet. We are waiting to hear. And we're really excited to hear what local officials think about this because community groups and the Alameda County Public Health Department have been pushing the city of Oakland in particular to adopt some proactive programs to address lead poisoning. And that they've been pushing the city for 7 to 10 years to adopt this rental inspection program that would go out and proactively look for lead hazards before kids got sick. So we do hope that local officials listen and think about some of the ways we can address this problem.
So you haven't heard from local officials yet?
Only people that we talk to in our reporting. We're hoping to still kind of share this, and we want to, to send this to the inbox of every Oakland City Council member. Because, yeah, they, like Marissa said, they've been throwing around this idea of this proactive rental inspection program that would make it so before a family moved in, you could inspect the property for lead. Because right now, we could test kids, we could figure out how many kids have lead poisoning, but those kids are still getting sick. We're not actually solving the root of the problem. Mm-hmm. And so if you make sure that a family moves into a house and before they move in, you know that the lead is gone, then that will, that will work. And Rochester, New York actually had a similar type of model. They had a lead poisoning rate, I think, 10 times the national average, and they used this proactive rental inspection model. And it reduced their lead poisoning rates by 80%. So
really?
The people we talked to at the Alameda County Healthy Homes Department, they are modeling their solution on that one.
So there's no need to reinvent the wheel. We know what actually works.
Right.
Yeah. And these rental inspection programs would go out, proactively look for lead. The city still needs to figure out the details yet. It could be before a family moves in. You know, a landlord would be required to do this before they rent out a unit. Or it would happen on a regular, ongoing basis. Maybe every 5 years, the city or county goes out and inspects for not just lead hazards, right? There are a lot of other hazards that families are living with that they might be afraid to complain to their landlord about, like mold, like other triggers for asthma, like fire hazards, right? And we've seen how that plays out when fire hazards are left unaddressed.
Marissa and Angela, you spent a year on this project, and this is an issue that you really need time to look at, to interview a wide range of people like you did, to look at public records, statistics, at a time when we're seeing so many cutbacks in the media. Can you talk about the importance of having the time to do this kind of investigating?
The time, I don't think the series would have been what it was if we didn't have that time. One of the things is to get to know these families. We spent time with three families over the course of the year. We really needed to build trust with them, especially because it's a subject that they're really afraid to talk about. One family, you know, it took three times for them to really warm up and open up to us about, you know, what it had been, how the lead poisoning had been affecting their lives. And, you know, you really need to, it doesn't just happen in one reporting trip. So, you know, we would go back many times, and developing these sources takes a lot of time. The public health nurse, Dieppe, that we followed, eventually she would be calling us on a Saturday morning saying, I just found another family for you that you should profile. You know, we were sad to not give all these different families that she showed us that their, you know, we weren't able to tell their story. But for example, she called me once and said, I have a family where the mother has lead poisoning, the grandmother has lead poisoning, and their daughter just now has lead poisoning. And this generational example, and she's constantly getting new cases. And we developed such a good relationship with her that we wouldn't have been able to do if we were just reporting this in a week.
Right.
And it really showed the scope of the problem, I think, to be able to dig into it with this much time.
We are very grateful for KLW for letting us take the time. And we were grateful for Reuters for shining a light on the problem in the first place through data. And then it was really great to come in and be able to do what we hopefully can do well as radio reporters and local reporters, which is bring in the stories behind this data problem.
The real voices that, you know, you can hear the stress that lead poisoning can cause when you hear their voices.
Are you doing follow-ups?
We have a lot of stories we still
want to
do.
I'm sure you do, especially politicians, local politicians. Once they respond, it would be nice to hear how they're going to deal with this.
Yes, definitely.
KALW News environment and health reporters Angela Johnston and Marissa Ortega-Welch spent more than a year sifting through data, conducting interviews, chasing down public records, and going into the field to report on lead poisoning in the San Francisco Bay Area. From KALW News, this is a nationwide problem, and they decided to specifically look in the San Francisco Bay Area. Angela and Marissa, thank you so much for this reporting, and thank you for coming in.
Yeah, thank you, Rose.
And you can find those pieces at yourcallradio.org. Your Call is produced here at KALW in San Francisco. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan produced today's show. Lauren Schechter is our intern. David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for joining us. It's Your Call.